Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Public Employees, Agency Shops, and the First Amendment Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 11, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association. Under California law and existing Supreme Court precedent, unions can become the exclusive bargaining representative for the public school employees of their district and establish an agency shop arrangement requiring public school employees either to join the union or pay a fee to support the union's collective bargaining activities. Although the First Amendment prohibits unions from compelling non-members to support activities unrelated to collective bargaining, in California, non-members must affirmatively opt out to avoid paying for these unrelated or non-chargeable expenses. Here, a group of public school employees sued the California Teachers Association and various other entities, arguing that the agency shop arrangement itself, as well as the opt-out requirement, violated the First Amendment. The district court denied their claim, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirmed, based on existing precedent and the 1997 Supreme Court decision Abood v. Detroit Board of Education. The two questions now before the Supreme Court are, 1. Whether the Abood precedent should be overruled and public sector agency shop arrangements invalidated under the First Amendment, and 2. Whether it violates the First Amendment to require that public employees affirmatively object to subsidizing non-chargeable speech by public sector unions, rather than requiring that employees affirmatively consent to subsidizing such speech. To discuss the case, we have Richard A. Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law, New York University School of Law, and Professor Emeritus and a Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Hi, this is Richard Epstein speaking from the Hoover Institution. I teach law at NYU and I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. And for many years I've worked on labor and labor-related issues. And it turns out that the case that I'm about to talk about today involving Rebecca Friedrichs against the California Teachers Association may mark a sea change in the way in which we understand labor law going forward. To put the case into perspective, it's important to go back before 1935 and to understand that the common law of labor relations essentially allowed firms to negotiate or not to negotiate with unions as they saw fit without any kind of penalty, and also to deal individually with individual workers so that you had something that looked more or less like a competitive market. The great innovation, if you could call it that, of the New Deal era was essentially to say that after Democratic elections in some designated unit, a union would become the sole and exclusive bargaining agent for all its members. And this immediately had two dramatic consequences, which 80 years later are still important. One is it meant that a manufacturer or an employer faced a unified front on the part of workers, which had the power to exact monopoly rents, at least if in fact those were available in the larger market, which in 1935 they often were. And it also created a kind of a complicated system internal to the union with respect to governance, because a union in representing everybody would necessarily have to make choices amongst the individuals whom it represented, and it would be inevitable that some would prosper more under union rule than others, and indeed some might in fact fail. For a very long period of time, if you put aside the race relations cases, the general attitude on the part of the Supreme Court was that these kinds of internal conflicts on various kinds of issues were more or less to be understood as part of the business of having labor organizations. And so a system of rational basis review, such as we had on economic issues, meant that you tolerated this kind of wobble. What happens is starting in the 1960s and 1970s, there was now a tendency to think that labor involves not only economic issues, but it also involves political issues. So economic liberties is not the only rubric under which these cases are understood. There is also the question of how they are to be understood in terms of political speech and participation, since unions collectively lobby all sorts of government officials and make all sorts of other political activities. In 1977, Justice Potter Stewart, kind of a conservative moderate on the Supreme Court, put forward what is commonly called the Abood Compromise. This was a case involving the Detroit Board of Education. And what he said is, to the extent that there were expenses that were properly chargeable to collective bargaining, those could in fact be exacted from all union members. And from people who were not union members, they could be collected in the form of agency fees. And the argument was explicitly made that this is needed to prevent free riding, whereby people would leave the union, let other people do the work, and get all the benefits for themselves. But on the other hand, Justice Stewart said that when it came to the political activities for the union, or whether or not, for example, you want to modify the National Labor Relations Act by having a car check system or something of the sort, workers had to be given the option to opt out. That was not a free option, as it turns out, because generally speaking, if you opt out on that score, you were out of the union and could not participate in its governance measures. And for about 40 years, this system seemed to be relatively stable. Then recently, there were two important cases, one called Knox and one called Quinn v. Harris, in which it turned out Justice Alito, for the conservative guys, said, you know, this line that we start to see between bargaining on the one hand and political activity on the other is much more shifting and unstable than was previously understood. Unions are always doing both no matter what they are doing, and so the case is no longer an economic liberties case subject to rational basis review. It is now a First Amendment case subject at the very least to some kind of intermediate scrutiny. And the Friedrichs case essentially now takes the intimations of the conservative judges and asks whether or not they shall be converted into a form of constitutional law such that the agency shop is illegal in the sense that any worker who decides that he or she does not want to contribute to union for any purposes is free to stay outside the union, which then has to work as best it can on its own devices. And in coming into this particular argument on that issue, a lot depends upon what metaphor you use for non-union workers. And it turns out that the traditional metaphor taken from the public choice literature was that of free riders, i.e. people who get something for nothing. During the course of the oral argument, it's quite clear that along ideological lines, the five conservative justices, almost to a man in this particular case, all took exactly the opposite position. They started to call these people compelled riders, i.e. individuals who were required to contribute to a union, even if they thought they would be better off without a union, even if they thought they would be better off without a union, even if the union offered them membership for free. And so the question then came up whether or not the compelled rider metaphor was going to dominate the free rider metaphor. And as you listen to the argument, it became pretty clear that it looks as though by a 5-4 vote, the traditional rule of Abood will be overridden and that the agency shop will be ended on constitutional grounds. The way the argument broke out was that Mr. Carbon, Michael Carbon, spoke first on behalf of the petitioners, Friedrich, and he was confronted by a barrage of questions from liberal justices. I'm just going to mention two of the points here which I think are most instructive. One of them, stressed by, for example, Justice Sotomayor, was, look, we allow for the employees and the employer of a private union to negotiate on behalf of dissenters unless there's a state right to work law in place. And if private employers are going to do this, why can't public employers do it? And this argument was constantly stressed by Mr. Dumont, who was a solicitor for California. And he said, you know, we employers love to deal with a single entity out there because otherwise our collective bargaining strategies become much too difficult. So if it works in the private side and employers want this kind of a situation, who are you to say that we cannot have it? Carbon, I think, stood his ground pretty gamely, and he said, well, public unions are really different from private unions because the state is governed by a First Amendment position, which means that the political views have to be given more weight. And then as the argument went on and Carbon sat down and the three lawyers for the government got up, or the other side, that was Mr. Dummett from California, a man named Friedrich who represented the unions, and Donald Verrilli, who was the Solicitor General of the United States, all of a sudden the liberal judges were mainly quiet, somewhat supportive, and the conservative judges or justices went to town attacking all of these guys. The free rider argument did not seem to carry much weight. Justice Kennedy weighs in very heavily with the compelled argument, and people like Justice Roberts, who were thought to be on the fence, said, look, you know, other unions do just fine without having this coercive power. Why do you need it in this particular case? And so as the argument started to go on, it became quite clear that the five conservative justices were not concerned with the second point, which I should mention, which is the power of precedent in this case, which was heavily pressed by Stephen Breyer. They were much more concerned about what they thought to be the internal justice and the coercive effects and the entire operation of the basic system. So as you listen through the argument and watch this thing sort of unfold, one justice after another, except for Justice Thomas, who was silent, expressed his real doubt, I would say almost amazement, that anybody could think that the Abood synthesis would work. Justice Kennedy put a point which is dear to my heart when he said, look, I mean, it may well be that everybody wants higher wages, but it's also clear that in many ways there are deep conflicts within a union. Some workers are in favor of merit raises. Some are against them. Some are in favor of seniority. Some turn out to be against that. Some think there ought to be differential wages for science teachers and for liberal arts teachers. Others think the other way around. He says these conflicts are absolutely rife, and it turns out that if you then look at what a union does, it represents on these issues not only when they're at the bargaining table, but also when they do their lobbying activities. And so Justice Roberts, for example, kept asking the question, could you tell me anything which doesn't have a political overtone? And it was clear from his answer that even when people talked about mail rooms and mileage allowances and lunch breaks, as far as he was concerned, all of that had a political dimension as well. So looking at the particular case, it seems as though the free riders will lose out to the compelled riders by a 5-4 vote. The question, as you step back a bit, is how should you think about this in the abstract? And my view is that the reason we have these terrible line-drawing problems is the initial mistake that was made in 1935 when collective bargaining was allowed over the strong historical objections. One needs to recall that first in 1908 and then in 1914, the United States Supreme Court struck down, first at the federal level and then the state level, mandatory collective bargaining arrangements on the grounds that they limited the freedom of association of employers, freedom of contract, to walk or to do business as they saw fit. And I happen to think that that argument is absolutely right, and that everything else that you get is a kind of a jerry-built compromise. It's not easy to figure out how you could have a world in which freedom of association matters for the First Amendment, but freedom of association doesn't matter for the purposes of the Fifth Amendment. And what you're seeing here is a real effort on the part of the judges to figure out what's going on. If, in fact, you take the economic liberties approach on this issue, as I do, then the free rider problem undertakes a very different complexion from the way it does here. The basic mindset of modern judges is that free riders are bad in an economic sense, and the union is able to make workers work together for their mutual aid and protection. My view about it is that that phrase, mutual aid and protection, is just a thin disguise for cartels. Competition always involves free riders undermining the monopoly positions of other individuals. So under the modern law, we're talking about the free rider as though he's a bad guy and the compelled rider as though he's a good guy. My view is the free rider is a good guy because it undermines monopoly power, and the compelled rider is a good rider because he shouldn't be coerced. So if in fact you come to the conclusion that both these groups should be treated in the same way, then what you do is you see the enormity of the stakes in this particular case. The First Amendment will surely upend huge portions of the National Labor Relations Act. If one looks at Wisconsin, where by legislation the bargaining rights of unions over wages and key positions were terminated, union membership plummeted. There was some time spent by both of the justices, all the justices, on the question about opting in and opting out under these circumstances. Right now, the rule is a worker has to opt out at some price, The conservative justices were skeptical about that. My guess is they won't reach that opinion when the case is ultimately decided. What will happen is they will come to the conclusion that the Abood effort to draw the line between the political and the economic is no longer viable. They will strike down the decision, and it will mark a huge transformation in American law. The deferred standard and the deferential standard of economic liberties will be in part swallowed up by the more aggressive standards of First Amendment jurisprudence. And as we always say in constitutional law, the standard of scrutiny you bring to a particular case often defines the way in which the entire thing plays out. So this is Richard Epstein speaking on behalf of the Federalist Society, wishing you all a prosperous new year.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.